Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2021. The Historical Novel Society Australasia acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this season of Imagining the Past, we'll take a sneak peek at writers and issues showcased at this year's Historical Novel Society Australasia's virtual conference, which will be held over two successive weekends on the 16th and 17th of October and the 22nd to 24th of October 2021. The online conference offers boot camps and craft workshops, with the main conference program featuring 2 days of interviews, panels and chat salons for both writers and readers of historical fiction. For more information, please visit hnsa.org.au. In our upcoming podcasts, I'll be chatting with some of the conference guests about their work and their inspirations. So pop on the kettle, pop on your headphones, and let's start imagining the past. Sienna Brown was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and grew up in Canada. But it wasn't until she moved to Sydney that she came across William Buchanan's story and was struck with a sense of fate. This story of a lost man far from home resonated with her own feelings of displacement. In 2020, Master of My Fate won the Mudd Literary Prize for Best Australian Debut Novel and was also shortlisted for the ARA Historic Fiction Prize. I started by welcoming Sienna to Imagining the Past.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So what was your first inkling you had to be a writer?
I wish I could say I knew at an early age that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't. I had to go down other creative roads, sort of go through a whole other period of creativity before I sort of got to the end point, which was ultimately to arrive at what I believe is really my true passion. You know, a lot of writers come out of the womb almost going, oh, I'm going to be a writer, and they know it. But that wasn't my path. And in a way, maybe I just had to go through lots of other experiences. I think also when you're a migrant as well, and having lived in three countries now, Australia is my third country, I think that kind of shatters some kind of lineage. It creates a break. And so, and in each case, I took up a new career. You know, when I was in Toronto, I was a professional dancer with Toronto Dance Theatre. And then when I arrived in Australia, I worked my way through and became a professional documentary maker. So, and at the time, writing didn't seem like an avenue that was open to me. If anything, it's happened quite late. But I'm also quite grateful because I think I have experiences that I can draw on, and an understanding, a deeper understanding of perhaps what the human condition is. I mean, I do have to say that throughout all of that, I've been an avid reader, and I think as a writer, you need to be that. I think you need to read all the time. And certainly from an early age, I was doing that. Our home always had bookshelves filled with books. And so I started reading very young.
So what was the first inkling you had of Master of My Fate?
Yeah, well, look, I had no idea that at the beginning of my research, I was actually going to be writing a novel. You know, when I started research, I was a guide at High Park Barracks. And when I discovered that Caribbean men had arrived as convicts, essentially debunking the myth that only Anglo convicts were transported, I thought what I'll do is I'll collate all that fabulous research that I'm discovering and put it in an archive, and hopefully a writer will come along and, you know, discover it and use it to create their own stories. Little did I realize that I would be that writer. I would be that person that would actually do that. And, you know, I was actually thinking about that the other day, how interesting that 10 years ago when I started the research, this idea of non-Anglo convicts arriving on our shores was a hidden secret, so to speak, apart from a few academics that had already been working in that arena. Whereas today, now it's actually an accepted fact. So I thought, well, you know, maybe there has been some form of service provided by doing that research, and I hope other writers also benefit from it.
Jamaica has an incredible history, a long history. I'm just wondering if you could just give us a small potted view of that, because it helps to contextualize the novel.
Jamaica, or the Caribbean, was discovered, quote unquote, by Christopher Columbus. He landed in Jamaica on May the 5th, 1494. This was his second set of voyages to the region. And at that point, it wasn't terra nullius, as Australia had been declared. There were actually people there, First Nations people called the Taniyo. And they were, of course, divided into tribes, as Australian First Nation people are. And one of the major tribes were the Arawaks and the Caribs. And in fact, the Caribs was a name that the Spaniards gave to this tribe. And that's where the word Caribbean actually comes from, the Caribbean Sea. Before that, if you want to go back about 7,000 years, 7,000 BC was when this migration started from Latin America, if you like, from South America, and traveled up through Trinidad, Bahamas, and up and up and up till arriving at Cuba was the last port of call, if you like, in those islands. And then, of course, there was a shift 15 years later. Jamaica in particular fell into British hands in 1655. You know, the Spanish went to these islands looking for gold, and Jamaica didn't have gold, but what it had was black gold. It had a fertile, extremely fertile environment. And this allowed the British to establish a slave plantation economy. And that economy lasted for another 300 years. And, you know, the British got very wealthy off the backs of slaves and off that land. And that's how it became known, the island that it is today, I guess.
I grew up in Tasmania, which is a small island as well, but I think it's actually quite a lot larger than Jamaica, and with a much smaller population. But I'm just wondering what growing up on an island kind of did for your imagination.
Well, I think it's a little bit different because I think even though it's very tiny, you know, tourism was a big part of Jamaica's, what would you call it, the romance of traveling to the Caribbean, to the tropics. So there were peoples, different kinds of peoples moving through the island. Music, dance, festivals was a really big deal when I was growing up. So there wasn't this sense of isolation in terms of a creative output. It was more in terms of, are we part of a larger network, a larger group? You know, the dominance of the US in the 60s, 50s and 60s was rapidly growing. And so I think everybody was sort of looking towards that. There was also, of course, the Windrush generation, those that looked to Britain, to the mother country. And they returned in droves or went there in droves seeking a better life. So, yes, I don't think it was about isolation. I think creativity was really ripe there. And if you wanted to become involved in that, I was taking dance classes and, you know, like quite a number of middle-class kids, I guess. People were taking piano lessons. People were involved creatively on a certain level. So I don't think it was the same kind of isolation that I certainly felt. Yeah.
But did it, your creativity, do you feel like the growing up on the island, it gave you something that perhaps you wouldn't have got in, you know, living on a larger piece of land in, you know, in America or Canada?
No, if anything, I think, the wonderful thing about Jamaicans and West Indians in particular is it's, and I think Australia is a little bit like that. We can do it. We can do whatever we want. We're full of the vigor of life. And I think it had more to do with the fact that my family was creative, had a creative base. And so, well, one side did. My mum's side was creative, and my dad's side was more in the financial end of things. So it wasn't, I didn't have to push against or fight against or to be accepted in that arena. And so I think it was just a given, really, that I would move on through the creative fields. I mean, it's so interesting now that I've got involved with research, looking back, I kind of have this feeling that I wish I had kind of known that before. I would really have liked to. One of my little, secret passions was archaeology, and there was a part of me, and history, in fact, and there was a part of me that thought, I wonder what my life would have been like if I'd been one of those people that went to the desert and dug around in the sand to find, bits and pieces of other people's lives. That's something that's always intrigued me. And maybe that's why I've ended up sort of writing historical fiction.
Well, the research for the novel must have been quite long and drawn out because you've got at least two or three distinct parts to it with the setting in Jamaica, Britain, and Australia. I'm just wondering what the differences were between the different parts of the research.
Wonderful thing, of course, about the Australian was that I was living in it. I was embodied in the research in the sense that at Hyde Park Barracks was actually the building in which convicts were imprisoned during the 50 years of convict transportation, and the records were actually there. So, and across the street was St. James Church, which was part of the convict era. Around the corner was St. Mary's Cathedral. There were many, many buildings in that in downtown Sydney that all you had to do was step outside and you were kind of enshrined, enshrouded in that period. So, and of course we've got magnificent research at the Mitchell Library. I spent a lot of time on Trove, digging around. In fact, that's where I discovered a lot of the information about William's life as a convict in Australia. So that was kind of easy pickings on a certain level. It got harder when I started to move backwards in time towards Jamaica. You would have thought because I am Jamaican, that would have been easy. I had emotional recognition of what that felt like to live in that landscape. But in terms of research, it was actually quite difficult. I mean, you're talking going back to the 1800s. And one of the things that turned my research around was when I finally was sent the slave registers of William and his family. Up until that point, all I knew was that he was a convict from the Caribbean. I didn't really realize that he was also a slave, and that sort of tipped the whole research on its head, really. And then that led me to then looking and going to Britain with the Kent Archives and discovering the trial transcripts of these slaves who were involved in a rebellion in 1831, 1832. So it was quite a long circular process, if you like. And of course, one thing led to the other. As you know, with research, you're like a terrier with a bone, and you just keep every little piece of the puzzle comes in, and then it triggers several other pieces of the puzzle that you keep sort of digging and digging and digging. So each one had its own process, and each one revealed different aspects of this amazing character whose life was larger than fiction.
What period of time did all the research take you over how long?
Oh, look, I think really, I try to pretend it was a short period because I feel embarrassed it took so long. It's probably over a period of, 8 years maybe, which isn't that long really. I mean, sometimes that's how long it takes to write a novel. But I think it's because, I wasn't a novelist. I wasn't an author at that point. It wasn't like I sat down and thought, okay, this is going to be my third book. I'm going to write about this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to blah, 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 blah. It was just this unfolding, which in a way was more about an unfolding of me and where did I belong? Where did I fit in to this vast landscape of Jamaica, Australia, and even Britain? Because up until that point, I always felt like a bit of an outsider. I'm sitting on the outside looking in all the time. As a migrant, sometimes I think that's the feeling that you have. And so in the process of doing this research, I started to sort of be transformed. I sort of returned to an authentic self, a self that perhaps had got lost along the way, having lived in three countries. And one of which is, of course, Jamaica is at my heart and always will be. But to then uncover one's history of one's birthplace, which you would have thought I would have known a lot about, but I didn't. In fact, I probably realized during it that I knew more about Australian colonial history than I did about my own birthplace's history.
You use the patois or a patois to write the novel. And was that hard to find and hard to establish that voice?
Yes and no. It was hard because in my mind's eye, I thought, oh, I'm going to write this amazing, academic, lovely, lyrical book, you know, about these amazing people and blah, 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 blah. But when I really started thinking about it, I thought, well, slavery has an oral tradition, a bit like our First Nations people here. And it was to write as a slave, I couldn't use beautiful English, beautiful lyrical language that I actually really love. So I had to come up with a convention, a way of showing that this person was a slave, but was still able to communicate his thoughts, his feelings. And how do you go about that? So I kind of, the patois that's in the book is semi-invented in the sense that it was based on consistency, deciding that there'd be 10 words that I would always use in terms of the patois. But it was also based on, for instance, the Jamaican dictionary, which I had at hand. And in fact, my mum had been part of the research on that. And so I could look up certain words and it would say, you know, this came into being in 1841 and meant this and that and this and that. So in terms of what's in the book, it's very authentic. And I was also lucky enough to have a mentor, Barry Hickman, Professor Barry Hickman from ANU, who has written many, many books on slave economy and plantation life and nonfiction books. And he was able to get back to me and say, well, actually, a slave wouldn't talk about the weather. They would talk about seasons in relationship to the plantation, to the planting of the sugarcane, to the reaping of the sugarcane, to the milling of the sugarcane. So even things like that changed my understanding of how to write the book. And then on a technical level, through an editing process with the editor, you know, I went through a very long period where I took out all the, I changed the grammar, if you like, and I made very short sentences to sort of whittle down and make it as simple as possible. And then gradually at the end of that process, I then started to weave sentences or those short sentences back into longer sentences. And also throughout that process, William's voice started to appear. So obviously I was on the right track. And eventually his voice took over and I could tell the difference when I was writing, when it was his voice and when it was my own. And it was very distinctive. And the choices that I, as William, made were different to the choices I, as a writer, would have made. So it was a fascinating process, actually.
I'm just wondering, is the use of present tense part of the patois? And there must be many different languages spoken across Jamaica.
Oh, no, but you're spot on, Greg. patois is spoken in the present tense. I think a lot of oral tradition is spoken in the present tense, because you're not having to talk about, well, you do talk about what happened the day before, but it's not a, doesn't have to be grammatically correct. And yes, so it is writing in the present tense, but I think it was bigger than just from a language point of view, because when I first started writing, I was writing in the third person past, and it just wasn't quite working. It was okay, you know, but certainly it wasn't gripping, I didn't feel, and I certainly wasn't as emotionally connected. But as soon as I switched to first person, and then as soon as I then moved into first person present, everything changed after that. And I believe that's actually when William's voice became the strongest. And I knew that I had to honor that and speak in that first person.
I thought the title for the novel was quite audacious, Master of My Fate, by Sienna Brown. I don't know that a male writer would kind of get away with that. I'm just wondering if you could tell us a bit about arriving at that title.
Do you really think it's audacious?
Yeah, I do. That and other things.
Uh-oh. I wait to hear. I don't think it's audacious at all. And you know, I mean, if it comes across that way, then hey, that's great. I mean, it couldn't be other. It would confuse things. I couldn't write Mistress of My Fate, because that would be about me, the writer, and not William, the main character. So it had to be written that way.
So you think a writer who's doing their job can be genderless, raceless, and ageless?
I think a lot of writers have flipped genders. And let's face it, writers are not writing about externals. Well, the characters are presented externally, but we're really writing it about an emotional landscape within our characters. And that emotional landscape, I think, is often genderless, raceless, and ageless. You know, it's right at the kernel of our characters is the big thumping heart that expresses itself through dialogue, through action. And that's really what we're writing about, which is the human condition.
How many people were transported from Jamaica to New South Wales, and over what period of time did that happen?
I think at the barracks, Hypat Barracks, there's a database which talks about the fact that they recorded over 700 convicts, whether men or women, of colour, from all over, because don't forget we're talking about the British Empire, which spanned from sea to sea. And, you know, they were often sent to Australia. If they were the bad boys or the bad girls, they were transported, just as English convicts, Anglo convicts were, for very, very little, whether it was stealing a loaf of bread, or in the case of the West Indians, a lot of times it had to do with either rebellion, or it had to do with stealing cattle or horses, or even stealing from other slaves themselves. So that's quite, it might not seem like a large number, 700, but I think there was quite a lot, and that went on. I think convict transportation ended in 1848 or thereabouts. 52 was the final out in Western Australia, I think. So from 1788, that's quite a span of time, I think.
So are there descendants of those communities still here who identify with these stories?
Yeah, actually there are. And I was really amazed to discover that. I mean, that's part of, you know, I wasn't able to bring a lot of that into the novel because it was just a huge trajectory about William's life and his family's life. But since then, I've actually been commissioned by Radio National to do a podcast called Caribbean Convicts in Australia. And that process, that podcast is about searching for the descendants. And so, well, yeah, I found a few. Essentially, with these guys, they came over with quite a few skills because, you know, they were working on plantations, so they actually had agricultural skills. Or in the case of William, he was listed as a good mason on his convict indent. And, yeah, so they went out into the community, into rural New South Wales at that particular time, and led a relatively regular life, if you like, married bore children, and there could be other, there could be Australians out there not realizing that they have a West Indian ancestor. In fact, just the other day, a reader got in touch with me via my website to say that his great 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 grandmother arrived in Melbourne in 1853 and had been a slave, enslaved to her master, who eventually married her and had four children
Wow.
with her. And those, when he died, he in his will, he freed her and left her all his money, and she took that money and sailed to Melbourne in 1853. Why? I have no idea. In fact, he was a Jewish merchant, and so she probably arrived quite wealthy, quite wealthy woman. And yeah, so, and I think the story goes that she lived till about 102.
Wow, what a
So,
melting pot Australia is, honestly.
absolutely, absolutely.
There are three court cases within the novel. I'm just wondering how you, if you actually got the transcripts of those court cases, and how did you come to put all that together?
Yeah, sure. Well, the transcripts were fantastic because they really gave me insight into what had happened. And William's story, why it's so fantastical, is he was brought to trial three times. The first time, along with his mother Stella, for presumably killing their master, Cargill Mowat. The second time was because he rebelled. He was part of a slave rebellion. And that's why he got transported. And then the third time, he was a bushranger and had escaped from Hyde Park Barracks. Pretty much within about 2 months, he escaped. And I also found the trial transcripts of when he finally got caught and brought back to the Hyde Park Barracks. At that point, he was very lucky because they were actually executing bushrangers in 1838. But he managed to escape that, the noose, and he was given 3 years in leg irons. Not that that would be a great outcome, but at least he was alive. But reading the transcripts are difficult because they're always seen from the opposite side. So, for instance, the one about killing his master, slaves were not allowed to speak on their behalf. But other slaves could come in and say things against that particular slave, and in fact they were probably paid to do that in a lot of cases. So yeah, and what's very strange is that Stella, his mother, her in looking at the Jamaican research, which is mainly based on slave registers, she disappeared. They started only in 1817. The second one in 1823, she was no longer part of the slave register, but William and his siblings were when they got sold on sold to another owner. And it took me ages to discover what had happened to her. And in fact, I found that trial transcript on the Macquarie University law site of all places late one night. When I was, I thought, I've got to find this, I've got to find this. And it just showed up, which means that, with research, it wasn't that it had, it must have just been uploaded because I had been searching and searching and searching. So when I saw that sort of brought all the pieces together. It also gave me a bit of a headache because when I discovered what had happened to Stella, and this is a spoiler alert for those who haven't read the book. It made me realize that here was a character that who I loved and adored, who might be disappearing from the storyline. And how was I going to deal with that? And was I going to keep to the facts, or was I going to lie and actually create a different story that she continued till the end of the novel? And you'll have to read it to find out what I decided.
I'm interested in the transcripts of, how detailed were they, and were they actually handwritten transcripts that you found?
Yes, they were handwritten, of course. And you know the what's so interesting when you're looking at research from past eras, a lot of times the depends on the facility of the clerk. If they have lovely handwriting, if they're good spellers, that's why sometimes names get changed. It's not that the person themselves changed the name, it's that the clerk recording things spelt the name wrongly, as we all do. We all make those kind of mistakes. So yeah, they were literally supposedly verbatim of what took place at the trial. So in Stella's case, for instance, there were several slaves who I also found on the slave register that came in to testify against her and said that she did certain things and said certain things, all of which, you know, added to the whole flavor, the whole understanding of what it would have been like in those days. Because that's the hardest thing, I think, when you're doing historical fiction, or perhaps what makes it really interesting is you have to put yourself into that period. You can bring your contemporary understanding and overview, but for you to get inside that character, you can't be someone that thinks the way we do in 2021. You have to be someone that thinks the way they did in that period. And so for somebody like Stella, who was a slave, who was navigating the waters of being enslaved, having a master who she probably hated and loved because he was the father of her children. Or I have made that assumption because in the research it came up that Cargill Mowat hadn't had children. They weren't listed anywhere. He wasn't married. So, and Stella's children are listed as mulattoes, half-breeds, mixed race. So the assumption, I made the assumption that he was the father. So yeah, but you know, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, like it's incredible to think that these records were actually made, and the fact that they've survived is another, level of uniqueness, really. I'm just wondering about the novel's prologue. If do you feel like if the novel had been published outside of Australia initially, would you have felt a need for it, or what kind of functions do you feel the prologue was serving you?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think it was as thought out as that. I don't think it was done strategically as that. Well, it certainly wasn't like that to begin with. I mean, that prologue was there again, kind of written by William, and I used it in a way to let the reader know that here is an individual that is a deep thinker, a deep feeler, and he's at the point in his life where he's about to unravel what's happened to him, that he's going to go deep into his memory bed and look back and call up what had ha happened to him. And I think by doing that, it allowed me to be quite intimate with the character from day one, so that even though he spoke as a 5-year-old, let's say, in this first person, I think I was then able to add a more in-depth understanding coming from that child. Whereas I think if we hadn't presented him at the beginning as a thoughtful person, it may not have worked as well, I think. And also to establish, yes, he's in Australia. You need to know that. And the other part of that prologue was also to establish that he had this little prick, and the prick was his mother, Stella, and what happened to her. And it's what sort of drove him through his life in a way to a conclusion. Because at the beginning of the novel, what we discover is that Stella says that her firstborn is not the master's, and she refuses to tell the master who the father is. So she becomes a very pivotal energy source, if you like, that kind of drives William, because he is thrown out. He becomes part of the unbelonging and unbelonged, because obviously if he was unlike his brother Sammy, who I set up to be the chosen one, to be the one that Stella says, yes, master, you are the father, and he gets the rewards, he gets treated differently as the master's son. So I kind of set up that dynamic between them, and that's hinted at in the prologue. That's a very long answer, but I think that was certainly the thinking behind it, behind the prologue.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to hear the moves that writers make, you know, towards certain things. Given that William is a slave, but a lot of his life is fairly, as a slave in Jamaica, is fairly good. He lives in a fairly benign environment. He does experience freedoms. And I'm just wondering if you kind of made those decisions around his life to kind of sanitize the slavery slightly, or to, I kind of felt it gave a more profound effect to the slavery because there was a contrast.
Yes, spot on. I did. That was intentional. I mean, one of the many reasons for writing the novel was I had read so many slave narratives, where even the really famous ones, even the really fabulous ones, but it was always seemed to be seen from the perspective of the owner, from the a very objectified, abstracted look at the black body, and the black body being brutalized, and the more brutal, the more that seemed to entice people, or, you know, it became how brutal could an owner be towards this black body, if you like. And I was really determined not to do that. I really wanted to talk about what it felt like as a human being, not an enslaved human being, but a human being who had other concerns besides the master. And I think a lot of the books I'd read were always the slave's dialogue, thinking, everything, he or she was always about in relationship to the master. And I thought, well, no, that couldn't, you know, like everybody else, they would be concerned about their mother, their brother, their sister. Do they have enough to eat? What's going to happen in the future? Where will I be? What's, you know, and that's really what I was trying to express. And I think in doing that, hopefully it's created an empathy towards people who are enslaved, that you no longer see them as this abstract body that things are done to, but that they're human beings who are having these full lives, that are experiencing things. And, you know, the interesting thing is that out of that, I have had people say to me, oh, well, then their lives weren't so bad. But yes, they were bad, but that wasn't the only thing about them, you know. And I've even had people say, well, because in the plantation system, they had their own plots of land where they had to grow their own food. So I've had people say, yeah, but they were given food, as if to say, that's a gift. The reason why they were given food was because it meant the master didn't have to give them a plot of land, because it meant the master didn't have to give them. And if they were hungry and starving too much, they couldn't work as efficiently for 12 hours a day in the plantation. So, you know, I mean, give me a break.
Yeah. It did remind me the life on the, you know, for the slaves. It did remind me in a really kind of odd way with Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Dissonovich, because, you know, he's living in a gulag and this terrible existence, but somehow, you know, human will and the human will to survive and to overcome and create society kind of drive everything forward. So it reminded me of that.
Oh, you're so sweet. That's really great. I don't think it's quite at that level of you know, authorship, but it definitely was a day in the life, or 50 years in the life of a slave. You know, so thanks for that. That's great.
One of the most chilling discussions, I think, in the novel for me was this open acknowledgement that the master's children and the parentage, but that he had indentured his own children to slavery. Was this kind of frankness and openness usual?
Well, I don't know about from an intellectual point of view, the way I've presented it in the novel, but certainly it was accepted. I mean, you're talking about what we call a Creole society. Black and whites mingled in a different way, I think, to the, drawing rooms of London. And often plantation owners would have a white wife, but they would also have a black mistress. And this was taken for granted on a certain level. Now, what is unusual is if you've got a plantation owner that only has a black slave or a black mistress or the mother of their children. And in a way, that means he's completely integrated into that society on a certain level. So, the story I gave the example earlier of the, the merchant, the wealthy merchant, having four children with his housekeeper, who then he frees and gives all his money to. That happened a fair bit too. And the other side of Master of My Fate was also influenced by this guy by the name of Thomas Thistlewood. Now, Thomas Thistlewood was a small plantation owner. He arrived in Jamaica he was born in 1750 and arrived 20 years later, so a little before William's time. And he wrote a series of diaries about his life as a plantation owner and a slave owner. And it's his diaries that have become, in a way, the penultimate British plantation slave narrative, if you like. Now, he had a wife, quote unquote, called Phoebe, who was a slave, and he had a son with her called Thomas. At the end of his life, he freed her in his will, and she then went on to be quite wealthy and had slaves herself. Now, having said that, there's an assumption that it's a great relationship. It's an equal relationship. It would never be an equal relationship. She would always be under the thumb of the master. But I think, as a woman, particularly in that society, I think if that's the way that you survived, you would definitely go along with it, and you would use it to your advantage, as many people have, whether they're male or female, within certain situations. You do whatever you can to survive. You do whatever you can to help your children survive. And obviously, if you're born a mulatto as opposed to a Negro in that society, in that Creole society, you're one step up. You're considered one step up, just a little bit further up. And then if that mulatto child has a child with a white person, they have a quadroon, which is quarter black, and they become even higher up the society chain. So the other side of Thomas, so in a way, I kind of based Stella and Cargill's relationship on Thomas and Phoebe's. I sort of use that a little bit as an inspiration for the possibility of that happening. And oddly enough, Stella was kind of, it's William's story, but really for me, it was always about the women in that book. It's always about my relationship to the women and what they were going through, and gave me a deeper understanding. I mean, for the male slave, it was incredibly difficult as well. They did have the possibility of having, a step up if they had craft skills. They were often the slave drivers, what they called the drivers. They were the ones that turned the slaves out. They worked in the mills, in the factory. Or, of course, you could be a field hand. But a lot of the field work was actually done by women. So the men took up certain power positions within that, but they were also ostracized because they were separated from the women. And I think women tended to slip and slide a bit more within that society. But yes, when I found out about Stella and what had happened to her, it's a strange thing, but my connection to the novel got broken, and I was broken by it, and I got quite ill, and I couldn't write, and I couldn't look at the research, and I couldn't do anything for several months after that. It was like this conduit had been broken, the female conduit, and I just and it took a while for me to stitch myself back up together. And then it made me realize, well, if Stella disappears from the storyline, what does that mean? And what's going to happen? And what am I going to do about it? So in a way, it became a pivotal turning in the wheel that I use throughout the novel, because she does return in various guises to push. And the last word on that, as soon as I saw that slave register and saw Stella and the three siblings of William, the old Obeah woman, Calla, showed up. Now, she's a fictional character, but there would be Obeah men and women within that slave world. And she literally walked through the door one day. I was writing, she showed up, and she inserted herself into the novel and became William's confidant, William's mentor, and also provided me with that source of female strength that I needed, I think, to continue writing.
And
So,
she's a marvelous character, and she really does straddle kind of two time periods and two different facets of the life on the farm. The novel ends with William almost free. It's although he's still imprisoned in Australia. In a way, I felt like he'd become like Jane Eyre in that rather than overthrowing everything, a revolutionary, she had kind of groomed her environment to suit herself and also accepted the limitations. I felt like William was quite like that by the end of the novel.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, that's such a lovely way to put it, Greg. Thank you so much.
You're
But I think that is what happened to William, and I think it had to be. It had to be, well, it was always going to be a bittersweet ending because he did receive a conditional pardon, which, on that piece of paper, it says you're free, but you can't go back to where you came from, which is pretty, bittersweet, I think. Eventually, some convicts did, make enough money that they could. I have no idea whether William went back or would have been able to go back. He was 50 at that point, and I think would have gone through a lot. I do remember one day, him speaking to me in the shower, the place that I think a lot of oral transmission takes place, because whoops, that
It's
But
true.
I,
It's
you
true, though.
know,
Like, how many good
yeah.
thoughts do you have when you're driving a car
Yes.
or in the shower?
Yeah, exactly. And I was at a workshop, yet again another writing workshop, so I could be a better writer. And what's your motivation? What's the character's motivation? The big question. And I kept saying, oh, it's about fighting for freedom and all of that. And it just didn't quite ring true, even though he was involved in that. And I heard his voice say to me, I want to be the master. And I said, what do you mean you want to be the master? You want to be the slave owner? He said, no, I want to be the master of my home. I want my own home, something that you and I and most people that we know completely take for granted. I want my own home that belongs to me, that nobody can kick me off, essentially. And so that's what I gave him at the end of the novel. And it kind of made sense because if his last ticket of leave took him to Goulburn, and so he's out in the country, and in 1851, that would have been pretty rural. So yeah, I just said, okay, you're going to get your plot of land and you're going to build on it. And good on you. And I hope that you've, are happy and contented at the end of your life. I bless you with that, and hopefully the way I wrote it in the novel might be close to the way it was in his life.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us today. I'm just quickly to finish off, I'm just wondering what you're working on now.
Oh, okay. Well, oddly enough, I'm working on two different novels at both ends, genres that are ends of the spectrum. One is historical fiction, also set in Jamaica and Australia, but 100 years later. And God, the research easier in that period, I tell you. And the other is a science fiction fantasy that I've been sort of working on in the background for a long time, because my one of my You know, my heart is split in two. I love historical fiction, mainly, I think, because I love research and time periods and imagining what it would be like to be somewhere else. And then on the other side, my brain also loves this idea of, you know, inventing a world, which is what happens in science fiction or fantasy. And I'm really enjoying the freedom of that, that I can do whatever I want in my own world, within reason, compared to the strictures of wanting to stay authentic and factual, even though it's fiction in history.
Well, thank you again for your time. I've really enjoyed the discussion.
I've really enjoyed talking to you, Greg. Thanks so much.
This episode features just one of over 70 speakers in our HNSA conference program. Our guest of honour is Geraldine Brooks. Other speakers include Stephen Carroll, Rosalie Hamm, and Kate Nunn, to name just a few. There'll also be special guest appearances from international best-selling authors Kate Quinn, Ben Kane, and Elizabeth Chadwick. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past.